I'm now joined by Chris Hedges, author of the new book, The World As It Is, Dispatches on the Myth of Human Progress. In 2002, he was part of the team at the New York Times that won the Pulitzer Prize for coverage of global terrorism, and he also received the Amnesty International Global Award for Human Rights. Now he writes primarily about American and Middle East politics and society. His books include War is a Force That Gives Us Meaning, What Every Person Should Know About War, American Fascists, The Christian Right, and the War on America, and Empire of Illusion, The End of Literacy and the Triumph of Spectacle. Welcome to Background Briefing, Chris Hedges.
Thank you.
And your new book, The World As It Is, Dispatches on the Myth of Human Progress. We're grateful to have it here in our fund drive, but in terms of the collapse of the left and the liberal class, as you've written about, what is there left in terms of the residue of any kind of movement to stop the inexorable corporate rape of America and the consolidation of oligarchical power?
Well, this is what's so frightening. They aren't there. And the movements that understood the danger and cruelty of unfettered capitalism, or one could even argue capitalism itself, were over the long course of the 20th century destroyed. The communists, the socialists, the anarchists, the radical labor organizations like the Wobblies, the old CIO, the great socialist publications, Appeal to Reason, the masses, they're all gone. And liberal institutions, and this is something I detail in my book, Death of the Liberal Class, disembowel themselves in this kind of perpetual red-baiting and hunt for people who were soft on communism. So thousands of university professors, high school teachers, social workers, journalists, figures like I.F. Stone, people within the State Department were all purged and shoved outside. And we've been left, because of that, utterly defenseless at a time when there is no check within the formal mechanisms of power on the corporate state.
But clearly what happened back in the 50s, where the Republicans were in the political wilderness after the long reign of FDR, they were able to take advantage of Cold War paranoia and hoist this canard that anybody that was liberal or progressive on domestic social issues was therefore aiding and abetting the Soviet enemy. And the sad part of it is that the left and the Democratic establishment didn't stand up.
Right.
And the Republicans, they've been milking that one forever. I mean, only up until the other day with Obama's killing of bin Laden, is there even a chance that the Democrats can look tough on communism or now, because it's tough on terrorism?
Yeah, the iconography and the language has changed, but the culture of fear and the permanent war economy remain untouched. We've just transferred our paranoia from the Communist Party to Al-Qaeda. Well, I think the Democrats and the liberal establishment are finally as guilty as the Republicans, because it gave us this disfigured political version of the neoliberal, of the person who placed national security as the highest good. And this was the only way to succeed within the Democratic Party, and one can go back several decades. The last Democratic candidate that we had that attempted to fight the military-industrial complex and security state was George McGovern, and of course, he lost 49 states.
Well, is there, though, a problem with the two-party system, in as much as we don't have a Labor Party in this country as they do in most of the other social democracies? And that with the weakening of labor over the decades, now down to about 6% of the private workforce is unionized. So the collapse of labor is absolutely wholesale. So I'm just wondering if, given the fecklessness of the Democratic Party and the nature of the two-party state, is there any way for the left to re-inhabit that shell? Because if the far right of the Republican Party, the so-called Tea Parties, which is just a rebranding of the Republican right, if they can take over the Republican Party, why can't the left take over the Democratic Party?
Because they have hundreds of millions of dollars in funding from Koch Brothers Industries. You can just run down the list. And the left doesn't have any funding. And as you correctly point out, it doesn't have the muscle of labor. The only thing the left ever had as a weapon with which to fight back were numbers. And with the destruction of the manufacturing base and the dismantling of labor unions or disintegration of unions, we don't have even the organizing capacity, or at least the foundations, which might make possible mass organizing. And that's what I find so frightening. As we play very dangerous games with our currency, you know, it's almost as if we have to start from scratch. And the worst part of it is that it's not being done. The left and the Liberal Party keeps getting seduced, or maybe terrified would be a better word, by the Democratic fear-mongering, which says, you know, look, you're going to get John McCain or you're going to get George Bush, without realizing that investing in the Democratic Party has not worked and isn't going to work, that the rise of this lunatic fringe within the Republican Party and across our political establishment is precisely the fault of a Democratic Party that has failed to address the basic needs and rights of working men and women, as well as the middle class. And that has become the engine which is empowering these terrifying proto-fascist movements. And as long as we continue to aid and abet a Democratic Party which serves the interests of Wall Street and the war industry as assiduously as the Republicans, then we are going to be complicit in this paralysis, this governmental paralysis that is enraging, and rightly enraging, tens of millions of Americans.
So, Chris Hedges, I totally understand the critique of the failure of the Democratic Center, which is essentially corporate light, where the Republicans are the wholly owned subsidiary of corporate America. The Me Too Party is corporate light. But just to go back to the analogy of how the far right of the Republicans, in the form of this rebranded AstroTurf fiction known as the Tea Party, have propelled themselves into a leadership position, at least it would seem so, with the Republican Party, isn't there also a critique on the far left that there is completely no narrative out there? I mean, when you've got people on the left supporting Gaddafi, supporting Hamas, who in turn support Assad, who's killing his own people, I mean, I don't know what moral and political bankruptcy would allow people to think that somehow Gaddafi and his spoiled brat billionaire Ferrari-driving sons are revolutionaries. So I'm in despair at the entire spectrum of the left.
Yeah, I think that, unfortunately, I share that despair. We don't have the vocabulary by which we can, well, certainly I think working men and women can explain what has happened to them, which of course is the language of class warfare. We don't have, as we did up until 1920, a viable socialist alternative. And when we so desperately need new ideas and new ways of reconfiguring the American political and economic system, especially with the collapse of globalization, which is in essence what we're watching.
But Chris, don't you think that you could make the case that it was the communists who did more damage to socialism than anybody else?
Well, I think you could make the case, as Noam Chomsky and others do, that the Communist Party certainly empower, or local communist parties who remained loyal to Stalin and Comintern were not in any way socialist. It just became another way to enslave the working class. And so I'm not in any way a defender of communism, and certainly as communism as it was configured in power. And yet at the same time, I define myself as a socialist, a democratic socialist, because I believe that our system is not sustainable as it is structured now. First of all, everything is 40 cents of every dollar the federal government spends is borrowed. The wars in Afghanistan and Iraq are funded through borrowed money. You know, we sustain both a level of consumption and an empire that we can't afford, $2 billion a day in debt we sell to the Chinese. And at some point, it's going to have to stop. And I think we have to begin to think about that before the collapse comes, because once a crisis like that envelops a nation, then you vomit up some very frightening figures. I watched it in Yugoslavia. The war in Yugoslavia was caused by the economic collapse of Yugoslavia. Everybody in Sarajevo knew Radovan Karadzic was insane. But especially after the currency collapse, we had hyperinflation. All of the traditional figures, parties, leaders in power were instantly discredited. And we're not immune from that.
So in this country, though, if a similar scenario were to take place, what would emerge from the detritus would be some kind of cornpone Nazi Christian.
Yeah. Robert Pax and others who've written about fascism make this point that fascism always appropriates traditional symbols and myth. I mean, it's why Italian fascism bore little resemblance in many ways to German fascism. And without question, that fascism in America would come wrapped in the American flag and clutching the Christian cross. And I wrote a book called American Fascists, the Christian Right and the War on America, to essentially explore the deeply totalitarian and even cult-like practices within the religious right. And in a moment of national turmoil, especially when you get out into states like Ohio or Missouri, or the only functioning center within these communities are these megachurches. All the old other civic organizations, from clubs to labor unions, they're all gone. The only sort of place that people have to recreate community within disintegrated communities are within these very frightening megachurch structures.
Well, I think when you say, Chris Hedges, the totalitarian impulse of the Christian right, there's no question to my mind that that has been translated into the Republican Party, which is dominated by the Christian right.
Yeah.
In as much as what that governor in Wisconsin and his conversation, the prank phone call that he had with the phony Koch brother, indicates a kind of totalitarian impulse. It's not that they want to have a two-party system and have a debate between liberalism and conservatism. They just want to eliminate all the funding for the Democrats. They want to absolutely crush them. It's entirely Stalinist. And the Supreme Court seems to be dominated by, I guess, the judicial equivalent of Stalinists. They want the corporatists to take over the country and have free reign. That seems to be their agenda.
Well, that's certainly, with Citizens United, that is what they have decided. And the Democratic Party has proved utterly feckless in its ability to fight back. Indeed, it isn't fighting back. It's serving even more assiduously the desires of Wall Street. That is Obama's whole tactic for reelection. And that's how he intends to attempt to raise $1 billion to run. So it's a question of how fast are we going to go to get there. But both the Democrats and the Republicans are headed in the same direction. Unless we begin to mobilize and build movements to put a stop to it, then we are going to live in a neo-feudal society, an oligarchic nation with a rapacious, tiny, narrow elite that uses the mechanisms of power and government to serve their interests at our expense. And that's already what's happening.
Just in terms of Washington, apparently now the staffers on the Hill working for Democratic congressmen and senators are saying that they can no longer afford to offend any corporation because of Citizens United. And they're being implicitly threatened by corporate power because of the unlimited coffers that corporations have. So the intimidation is already entrenched.
Well, that's how they took down Feingold. For every one ad that he put up, they had 5-6 ads and nobody knows who funded them. They tore them to pieces. So any kind of even tepid resistance to what corporations want means you are banished from within the political establishment.
Maybe I'm being Pollyanna here, Chris Hedges, but I'm searching for a silver lining in these dark clouds, albeit an accurate, to my mind, look at the horizon ahead. And nevertheless, there are some bright spots, I guess, the Arab Spring. There are indications that even as the United States is heading into a voluntary form of enslavement, other peoples around the world seem to be freeing themselves.
Well, they're fighting to. Remember that the traditional centers of power in countries like Tunisia and Egypt, which are the military, still have power. And they're the problem. Mubarak is a product of the military, or was a product of the military. But at least they're out there. They're fighting back. And that is what we have to do. I think a lot of it's going to hinge on food prices, which are now extreme, especially for the poor in countries like Egypt. Half of the country lives on about $2 a day, and over half of that money goes into buying food to eat. So with the huge rise in commodity prices, especially wheat, which has risen 100% in the last 8 months, this has, I think, proved an important motivating factor, and people begin to asking a lot of questions and challenging ruling elites. We now have a situation where the roughly 40, 45 million Americans who live in poverty are spending about 35% of their income on food. That's only going to rise, especially as we watch gasoline prices creep up over $4 a gallon. And I think that hunger is a powerful force when it hits you and your family, makes you ask a lot of questions you weren't asking before. So we're not going to be immune from this at all. The question is, how is it going to be channeled? How is it going to be expressed? And I think the left in this country is utterly asleep.
Well, but would you expect anybody in this country to exhibit the same courage that the young Syrians are taking to the streets, facing cannon fire and snipers? The young Libyans are doing the same, you know, dressed in jeans and T-shirts, taking on a modern army. I mean, it may be driven by desperation and starvation, but there's a courage there that I think we lack.
Yeah, I mean, one hopes that it will appear. We have much more sophisticated forms of control. We've decapitated the African-American community, which is traditionally our most astute community. We incarcerate staggering numbers of people, and any kind of real organizing is virtually impossible, given the sweep of the surveillance and security state, the monitoring of the emails, phone conversations of tens of millions of Americans, courtesy of the FISA Reform Act. So we have powerful mechanisms of control, which are already being put into place. Any kind of dissident, which is, of course, a figure like Bradley Manning, the techniques of psychological torture that are used to reduce them to to sort of break them, are being employed, and not only against Manning, but against other dissidents, Fahad Hashmi, or all of those in our Supermax prisons. So we're up against it. But I don't discount the possibility that people will. I mean, I think that everyone has a breaking point, and I think corporations know only one word, which is more. They're, you know, deaf, dumb, and blind to human suffering and human misery. And I think that they will push and push and push. They know no limits. I think that they will push and push and push until there is some kind of a reaction, whether it will be local, national. But I expect there will be a reaction. I'm just worried that the backlash will become a right-wing backlash.
Well, Chris Hedges, when you mentioned the price of gasoline, which there's a great deal of evidence that it's speculators that are driving the price up, and it looked like the bubble might have burst, but now they've got further excuses to raise the price because of floodwaters affecting the refineries in Louisiana. And I just did an interview the other day with the author of an article in Foreign Policy titled How Goldman Sachs is Behind the Food Crisis in the World. And, you know, the Goldman Sachs created the index, which is the bookie window through which speculators are able to buy these long-form positions on both oil and the basics that go into food. And by the way, interesting enough, the CEO of Starbucks just today in an interview on the BBC singled out the Goldman Sachs index as being the reason why coffee prices are going through the roof, and was talking about how speculators are just making money at the expense of the consumer.
Which, Ian, is why speculation in the 17th century in Europe was a crime. It was a capital offense. Speculators were hung for precisely that reason.
Well, from your lips to God's ears, I don't see it happening. But again, I'm wondering about the poor passive consumer that tips up at the gas pump. It seems to be just taking it. I guess people don't see, you know, the mainstream press is not telling us these things. You know, they're not interviewing the guy that I interviewed. They keep repeating all of these nonsensical notions about the market forces, and they do the same. They keep talking about the terrible deficit we have. They don't talk about that we actually are suffering from a revenue collapse, and that if you put people back to work, the deficit would cease to be in any way relevant. But, you know, I don't know where the catalyst is going to come from to be able for people to link what's happening to them, where they're being forced now to choose between the gasoline they need to commute to work and putting food on table for the kids. And by the way, when they do, because of their limited budgets, they're buying food that's creating an obesity epidemic because it's the only food they can afford.
Right. Well, you go into a city like Camden, New Jersey, which per capita is the poorest city in the country, and there's no supermarket. People eat donuts and fried chicken. The same is true in all of these post-industrial pockets, southern West Virginia, everywhere else. And I think that there will be a reaction. I worry that it won't be organized and it won't be articulated. People will lash out in a way that doesn't or isn't perhaps directed at the centers of oppression, which is why you have the Koch brothers steering the Tea Party away from Wall Street and pushing out all the Ron Paul libertarians who were focusing on Wall Street and targeting government. Because, of course, what they want is for government to become even more anemic, even weaker, so that there are no impediments to the creation of this corporate feudalism.
Well, that's the movement that seems to be out there that's growing in impetus and in numbers, the libertarians. And depressingly enough, a lot of young Americans are being seduced into that sort of bizarre world of Ayn Rand and this kind of mechanistic formula for organizing humanity, which, you know, is one thing missing from all of their formulas is the human the human aspect, the human factor is not factored in. I mean,
it's like Scientology. It's a pre-industrial ideology. The idea that you don't need forces to regulate ExxonMobil or Goldman Sachs or Citibank. This is the bizarre thing about libertarianism for me.
Right.
You know, government obviously failed. And all of the bulwarks that had been put in place by the New Deal didn't just protect the marketplace and protect the economy, but ultimately protected democracy. And now that they've been removed by both Republicans and Democrats, we're utterly defenseless. And that's what's happening. There is no way that in this country that you can vote or challenge the interests of Goldman Sachs. It's impossible.
Well, Chris Hedges, I thank you for joining us, and I thank you for your new book, The World as It Is, Dispatches on the Myth of Human Progress. It's always a pleasure to talk with you, and I imagine we'll be having another conversation.
Thank you,
since
Ian.
You are so prolific. So thank you so much.
Thanks, Ian.
Bye.